Welcome into episode number 21 of the 48 Minutes Podcast by Believe, where you stay up to date in 48 on all things NBA. I'm Ross Geiger, joined alongside my co-host World B, Michael Freer. And tonight we're excited to have Scott Williams join us as a special guest. He is a three-time NBA champion, 15-year NBA vet, a former assistant coach, both in the NBA and the D-League. And if you're still not impressed with that, he's also a former NBA broadcaster and current broadcaster for Grand Canyon University. Scott, I'm out of breath. Thanks for joining the show. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Ross. Thank you, World B, for having me on. I'm excited to be on 48 Minutes.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to start us off here for our opening tip and just segue into our discussion with you, Scott. You've got a soon-to-be-released book titled Through the Fire, a memoir of trauma and loss, basketball and triumph. Tell us a little bit about the process, how you came up with the title for it, and then I'm sure we can get into parts of your book.
Well, like everybody else during the pandemic, I was kind of early stages of when all the shutdowns were going on. I was jonesing for basketball, and the Michael Jordan documentary really saved everybody's bacon as far as that 10-part documentary. And I almost thought I'm drawing a blank on the name of it now.
The Last Dance,
of course, yes. Yeah. So getting a chance to watch that, everyone that I knew kind of surrounded their Sundays, like, what are you going to have for dinner? And are you going to drink a little bottle of wine with your meal and get ready for The Last Dance to come on? So for 2 hours, that was kind of my life on Sundays. And it got me thinking about all the stories that they shared through, you know, Michael's career growing up and baseball and, all the things that his interest away from the game. Being cut from his high school basketball team, which is still mind-boggling, considering what a legend he went on to be in the NBA, got me thinking I wanted to share some of my stories that I had and some things that are raw that I have kind of kept deep down and suppressed for a long time about my childhood and the loss of my parents and the situation of my father taking a gun after my mother had left him and killing her and then turning the gun on himself, and how I had a wonderful support system in Coach Smith and the Carolina family to help me through a devastating time for a young, very young 19-year-old for me. I think 19 is not that young, but I won't say it's immature, but I was still having a lot of fun as a living my childhood dream of playing basketball at the college level. And so I had some shares, and I wanted to see if that one might be able to help some kids that, you may be going through tough situations of verbal and physical abuse, which I endured a lot in my childhood. And my brother and I, Albert Williams Jr., I call him Chip, we suffered from a lot of that and having to run out of the house for a fear of being beaten and hiding out of neighbors and, peeking through drapes, waiting for my mother to come home. And that it's not kind of how you start your life in the difficult hands that you might be dealt. And everybody's story is a little different. I'm not saying that everyone has to have a domestic violence situation or abuse situation, but everyone's got some things that they could be being holding them back, bullying and at the elementary level or sexual abuse, all kinds of different things that happen to children that are just put in harm's way in a bad light that can really derail a youth. And I thought if I shared some of that along with my story of how I overcame a lot of those, verbal abuse, telling you you're not good enough, you'll never be SHIT, all those types of things, coming from a parent, someone close to you that you're supposed to, think would be loving and supporting, that if I can do it, and I'm not special in any stretch of the imagination, that another child out there might be able to do that too. So it gets you a little real, a little raw. I was tough to write. Didn't think it would take me 2 years, but the emotions that get stirred up in that, and I'm thinking about, abuse and the cycle of abuse and the things that I learned having spoken to domestic violence centers over the years, that I wanted to snap that cycle of abuse and not pass that on to to my children and be a better father and more loving and supporting than what I experienced was my number one goal. I wanted to win a championship. I wanted to be a better father than what I had. That was to my children. That was my number one goal. And it covers a lot of basketball, obviously. Dean Smith stories and Michael Jordan stories in Chicago. You know, playing in Philadelphia with Allen Iverson, and all the way to my final year with LeBron James as a young 19-year-old, I had a chance to lace him up with a guy who at the time couldn't have told me that he would be the all-time scorer in NBA history when I was looking at this kid at a 19-year-old with no jumper. But his work ethic was just tremendous, and I'm very, very happy for LeBron.
Well, that's really awesome. I mean, to a certain degree, it had to have been pretty therapeutic. Did you find yourself kind of getting some of that weight off your shoulders as far as just putting it down on paper and sharing it to the world and not keeping that a secret anymore?
Yeah, Ross, it really was painful and therapeutic, I guess, probably kind of sometimes go hand in hand in recovery. And yeah, I'm soon to be 55 years old. This happened to me when I was a 20-year-old. That's a long time, 19-year-old. So it was a long time ago, but the pain is still real, still fresh. Missing my mother, not being able to, for her to be able to see my dream or our dream, a shared dream that we had of playing in the NBA, Absolutely. I was always a little jealous of some of my teammates, folks that would come to the games and they would go out to dinner afterwards and celebrate the victory. And I didn't have, I was envious, maybe is probably a little bit of a better word, but happy for them, but a little bit envious as well that I didn't have that. So yeah, there's a lot of raw emotions. And I think that's why it took me the better part of 2 years, because I would start it and go, this is too painful, and put it down, and not come back to it for a while. But, I had, great fortune of having a writer helped me with this by the name of Ben Guest, and he is phenomenal and he was patient. And it took a while. He emailed me and texted me and called me to push me to get through this book because he believed in what we were trying to accomplish and telling a story that ultimately one day should help somebody or maybe a couple of people.
That's awesome. Really glad to hear that. Congratulations. It's a huge accomplishment to actually put it all together and excited to check it out when it comes available in a few weeks here.
What I'd like to do is I should have a QR code here by the middle of next week. I was hoping to have it before your show today. Yeah. Life throws curveballs sometimes. So I don't have that available today. But I should have it next week. Maybe you can extend the link when you archive your photos and your viewers and listeners will be able to go on and grab that QR code to be on Amazon's books sales. So that's where they'll be able to find it here in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, of course. We'll definitely go ahead and put that up on our social media pages and in the link to our podcast so our listeners can be on the lookout for that. That wouldn't be a problem whatsoever. But, kind of shifting to your early life, kind of give us a little insight of how you chose North Carolina, the decision going into that, and then kind of just your journey getting to the NBA.
Yeah, I was always a great athlete, long and lean, a lot leaner than I am today. You bumped into me at the Circle K the other day. Yeah. And I had the nerve to be walking out of there with a Red Bull and a bag of Twinkies. That was trying to say that I would get on a diet. So a little embarrassed that you caught me creeping at the Circle K. But, I started as a young athlete. My brother was 3 years older. And because I was so much taller than most of the kids my age, I played with him and his friends that were a little bit further along, developed athletically, whether it was basketball, baseball, football, whatever we were doing. And I was a great baseball player. I could pitch, I could hit, I could run, I could field, I could throw. And baseball was kind of my first love. And it wasn't until I got a little bit taller, the strike zone got a little bigger, the home runs weren't flying over the outfield anymore. I was catching more strikes on the outside corner or down along the knees. I decided basketball probably was a little bit better way for me to go. And Jet really fell in love with the sport, the fast pace that they had, you know, the back and forth offense and defense and rotating and over and help side and switching out on a guy, pick and roll, pick and pop, all the little plays you start to see develop as you become a little bit more immersed in the actions. I could dominate. Height was a big advantage, right? Like being taller than your teacher when you're in elementary school, and now you're playing against grade school kids, you know, and you get a feel of like, hey, this is cool. You know, you get some recognition. Guys are giving you high fives. You're building to be able to score. And I had a mean ass jump hook. Oops, can you say that? I had a mean jump hook that nobody could stop. Even my older brother's friends couldn't stop. When it was a little left shoulder turn, right hand jump hook. That I would use on guys, and if I needed a bucket, or if we were playing a game of horse and it was getting down to the nitty gritty, I'd bust out the jump hook on them. And nobody knew how to shoot a jump hook. But I grew up watching the Lakers, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was one of the Magic Johnson and Norm Nixon and Jamal Wilkes and James Worthy. These are the guys I idolized. In fact, I wanted to be James Worthy. He was my outside of Dr. J. He was one of the guys, as I started to get older, I wanted to try to pattern my game after. Sorry, James, to let you down there. But those are the kind of, but I always wanted to go to UCLA. I grew up in Southern California. I thought UCLA is going to be a great place for me. But at the time, Walt Hazard was the coach when I was, you know, entering my senior year in high school. They started recruiting a guy named Kevin Walker heavily. And he was the other 6'10 kid in town. There wasn't a lot of guys 6'10 running around the suburbs of Los Angeles. So we get into games against one of some of the holiday tournaments, man. We'd be mixing it up and going to blows. But I always felt like I got the better of our matchups. So they were recruiting him hard but not contacting me. I had schools like Villanova and DePaul and Georgia Tech and North Carolina all showing up on campus, coming to my practices, games, talking to my teachers and my principals, showing a large interest. My thought process began to shift away from UCLA. And when Dean Smith came to my house on official recruiting visit and sat down with all of his, you know, national championships and Olympic gold medals, and having coached my hero, James Worthy, and the new NBA sensation of Michael Jordan had come onto the scene, got my attention, got me listening. And he was crafty, because of all the coaches that came through, invited me on visits to their campus, Coach Smith was the one coach that invited my mother to come with me. And she was so excited that one of the coaches thought that she was worthy enough to come on the visit. She jumped at the opportunity and came with me. And before we ended up leaving, we arrived on a Friday. And by Sunday afternoon, she was telling Coach Smith that I'm coming to North Carolina. So she was sold a little before me, but I told her for family safety, I have to take a visit to North Carolina. But I think I knew then too. I mean, to UCLA, I think I knew then that I was going to be going to Chapel Hill.
Hey, Scott, real quick, if it wasn't UNC, where did you see yourself? Was there another school you were considering if it wasn't UNC, or was it you were locked in?
Yeah, there was really two schools that I really liked. DePaul University. I really liked Coach Joey Meyer. I thought our personalities connected real well together. I knew the history of his father having coached there. One of the players that took me around on my official visit that I had watched a lot was Dallas Comegys. I don't know if you guys remember that name, but he was a star player at the college level. But I got off that plane coming from Southern California in a little silk sweatsuit, and it was still early October, or maybe late September, and the kids were running around playing like flag football or something, like shorts and a t-shirt, and I was freezing in Dallas's little Datsun 210. I said, "There's no way, if these guys don't think it's cold yet, that I'm going to be able to survive the Hawk in December and January." So I politely had to tell Coach Meyer, thank you, but no thank you. I don't think I'm going to be able to make it in Chicago. And the other school was probably Villanova. You know, Raleigh Massimino was fresh off the national championship in 85. This is just a few months after that. So I kind of got caught up in that hoopla a lot. the campus. I don't know if you've ever been. It sits in the suburbs of Philadelphia in Villanova. Is beautiful. It is just an absolute beautiful school, kind of a Ivy League feel kind of to it, you know, ivy growing on the walls and all those kinds of things, and brick walkways through the quads. But I didn't mesh real well with some of the players that were on the current roster. They were doing some things that I wasn't all about back then. You know? So I just said, no, I don't Fair think enough. this would be a good fit for me.
Yeah. So now you end up at UNC. Talk to a second about, obviously, it's a blue blood school and everybody knows that. I'm sure you a lot of great stories, you had a lot of success, but talk about the expectations of playing at a school like North Carolina. How were they, or did you feel them, or what, and how do you think your teams reacted during your time there to those expectations?
Yeah, well, it was great. When we were loaded, man. I mean, we came in. It was I was a high school All-American, state of California player, Mr. Basketball. We had the number one recruit, a guy named J.R. Reed. He was the national player of the year. He was another 6'10 cat, 6'9". And he was coming there, a dude named Pete Chilcutt out of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, another McDonald's All-American, 6'9", 6'10 guy. Joe Wolf was our senior. Kenny Smith was in the backcourt. An All-American, number of great players like Jeff Levo, Dave Popson, Renzino Smith. So we were loaded. We were number one preseason. In fact, one of our guys, this guy named Michael Norwood, who was on that team, he shared a – we have a group chat going as everybody's got these text messages, right? It's a great way to stay in touch when we live and die with every North Carolina field goal. In fact, Notre Dame game almost killed me last night as they squeaked out a victory on the road by four. But he showed shared a picture of us all standing around underneath the basket with Coach Smith, who was so special as a mentor and a father figure for all of us, who we lost about 8 years ago last week. So I'm glad Michael shared that picture, because it's just all of us together looking up through a basketball hoop. It was wasn't on the cover, but it was inside. We were preseason number one, but there was a lot of expectations that came with that. You faced everybody's best game on a nightly, so you had to be up and ready to go. I mean, winning by four at Notre Dame when they won two of their last 14 games would not have been acceptable. I can't even imagine the fire and passion Coach Smith would bring to practice the next day when we had a subpar performance, because as nice as he was on camera, he'd break his foot off in your keister if you didn't perform up to what he thought your expectations were. And that was really good, because it helped shape all of us, not just the guys that didn't go to the NBA. All of us realized, to survive a Dean Smith practice, the work ethic that you got to put into, if you can put that into other aspects of your life outside of basketball, there's nothing that we can't accomplish. We have no fear of accomplishing any task that we set our mind to, because that man laid such a foundation in us to achieve all of our goals.
Interesting. So you have a successful college career at North Carolina, and I find it a little ironic DePaul was one of the schools you were considering in Chicago. Talk a little bit about the draft process. Were you expected to be drafted? And then how did you land in Chicago? It's just kind of funny. It's like, North Carolina, like, you remember Jordan, and then you end up in the city of Chicago where DePaul is, and you're playing with Jordan, another Tar Heel alum. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's actually, Ross, kind of a, I think, bittersweet story for me. Draft night was a bit of an embarrassment, because Al McGuire had said I was going to be kind of a middle to late lottery pick, and I'd done really well my senior year. Even though we had a bad year, I was rebounding the ball well, scoring the ball well, shooting a high percentage. Free throw numbers were still down in the 60s, but improving. And I seemed to make them when I needed to. But when I had to go to the combine in Chicago, and all the doctors start pulling and prodding on you. I had a bad shoulder. My right shoulder would sublux and dislocate in practices and games, and it would cause me to come out for a short period of time. But it never kept me out of anything. I learned how to deal with the pain and play through it. So I was always proud that I never missed a practice or a game because of my shoulder injury. But, you know, in the pros, over 82 games, these general managers are putting their own careers on the line, and they didn't want to draft a damaged player. So after the first round goes by, I got out of here, my name called, and I was sitting there with my roommate, Jeff Denny, and I think my girlfriend at the time, Fonzetta Badger, and my brother. I was embarrassed. I went back to the back bedroom, closed the door, and watched the second round go by, and I wasn't drafted, man. That was painful. I cried. As I had worked so hard through so much, I had an appendectomy my senior year that I only missed a game from. I came back and played, you know, kind of on half speed for a little while. But I thought I still put up good numbers. And I got lucky because Michael Jordan knew this dude named Fred Whitfield, who they work together down in Charlotte now, that was putting on a basketball game for campers. And there was a way to kind of get something back to the community. As Fred, very civic minded. And I got invited to go play in that. And Jordan brings a lot of guys from the league, Charles Oakley, Bimbo Coles, Del Curry, Steph's father. So I said, I jumped at the chance, and I got a chance to go up against Kenny Gattison, some of these guys. And honestly, I dominated the game, but I held my own. And I was on Jordan's team. And it was one of those games where it's hard to believe, but Jordan would tell you, but we playing hard. Not like that all-star game you saw last Sunday night. Jordan come to the locker room and tell these guys, you play hard or there's the door. You can leave. And like, we're not getting paid for this. Just showing up to get a run and give back as well. So we, you know, look around. Okay, all right. So MJ wants to go hard. We go hard, right? So late in the game, I grabbed an offensive board. We were down by one, and I found Jordan in the right corner. And instead of going back up with it, I threw it out to him, and he knocked down the shot. And so on his way out of the gym, riding with Fred Whitfield in this little tiny red convertible, which was too small, Corvette convertible was too small for him, he calls Jerry Krause, the general manager at the time of Chicago Bulls. And so Krause gave me a call and said, we want to bring you into Summer League and see if you can see how you do. Maybe we give you an invitation to Veterans Camp later that year. But I almost messed it up. Because I had an opportunity to go down to Charlotte, and they gave me a physical down there. They failed me on my physical because of my shoulder. And I said, duh, I mean, that's why I wasn't drafted. So I almost messed up, almost ended up in Charlotte instead of Chicago. Because once I got to Chicago, I ended up winning 3 straight championships, which was pretty damn sweet.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that? I know a ton of our listeners would be very intrigued just to hear your perspective on playing with some of the all-time greats, being on one of the greatest teams of all time, if not the best team of all time. Just what is that like, especially as a younger player? Obviously, you go on to play 15 years in the league, which is super impressive based off where you kind of started getting undrafted because of an injury and kind of prove the doubters wrong there. But just as far as that Bulls era is considered, I mean, what was that? What is that like as a young NBA pro?
So cool, so rewarding, but so hard. MJ, when I got there, had not won a championship yet. The Pistons had knocked him off 3 times, the previous 3 years. And then the year that I was finishing up college, it was in game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. And he was pissed. And he came into the training camp like a smoldering dragon. Everything we did was hard. I mean, and we practiced back then. It was the first 7 days were 2-a-days, no time on practice. If we go 2.5, 3.5, sometimes longer with film sessions before and after weight training and banging. Guys were beating the snot out of one another. And I was trying out for the last spot on the team with this dude from Georgetown named Ben Guillory. And we darn near took each other's heads off knowing that this was going to be – there was only one roster spot open. This is, and only carried 12 guys back then. you know, not the 17 or 18 that they got now with the two-way players. I think it's what they call them down in the G League and all. Yep. We didn't have all that, right? It was 12 dudes. Maybe some of the more rich teams would have a 13th guy, but that was it. So we banged at each other real hard. I mean, I got that last spot, and the first thing that they talked about was earning the home court advantage in the playoffs to the Eastern Conference, because they didn't believe they could beat Detroit Pistons at Detroit. And we worked our butts off in training camp, and wouldn't you believe, we start the season, we lose our first three games. So when you thought that was hard, it got even harder because Jordan was even more pissed off. It wasn't until we faced the Pistons the first time, they smack-caked us. They beat us by double digits and wasn't even close. And so, things were tough in Chicago. It wasn't a whole lot of joy. And guys worked hard. If you weren't ready to compete with MJ on a nightly basis in practice, if you weren't ready to run through a wall with that guy because he was out in front leading just like he did in every drill, every shooting competition, every two-on-two, any rebounding drills that we did, you'd have a problem with MJ, and he'd let you know about it. And a lot of guys thought that as him being a bully, but dude wanted to win. That's how I saw it. And I'm like, hey, I'm an undrafted player trying to earn minutes. My first five games, I sat on the bench. I didn't even get a chance to get out of my warm-ups. That had never happened to me at any level. So I'm out there trying to work my tail off just as much as he was. And I think I did. I worked harder than everybody except MJ. And by the end of the season, you know, I was playing against the Detroit Pistons in the Eastern Conference Finals. I was playing against the Los Angeles Lakers, my hometown team that I grew up, you know, idolizing Magic Johnson and James Worthy and Byron Scott and AC Green. You know, these are guys that I watched play as a little kid. You know, I was in my driveway counting down, you know, to the buzzer that Williams got the ball on the right side. 3-2 shoots it up. The Lakers win the championship, right? But I'm like, hey, if I got to win a championship through going through L.A., so be it. You know, blocking Magic Johnson's shot and taking a charge on Buck as he came through the lane. Those are memories I'll have for the rest of my lifetime. So it was a special time, but that first championship was probably the specialest.
Hey, Scott, going to that first championship, you obviously had to get by the Pistons in the Eastern Conference Finals, and it turned out to be a sweep. And the famous moment at the end, when the Pistons decide to walk off Isaiah, Bill, and all the rest of the guys. Well, some people don't know. The cameras focus on Michael as they're walking by, but you're right next to Michael in that shot, that famous shot as the guys are going by. What's going on at that moment? You can see the shrug on Michael's face as he can't believe it's going on. But what is going on on the bench at that point? What are you seeing as it's going on? And what was the reaction by the rest of the guys?
Utter disbelief that a two-time back-to-back NBA champion Detroit Pistons team that had knocked off the Bulls the previous 3 years couldn't muster the class, the dignity to wait for the final horn to sound. And I'm not saying they have a long conversation, but at least slap five, shake hands, and admit that they had gotten bested. But the way we had hit our stride towards the end of the season. We won 61 games that year, 61-21. And it hadn't been a team that had won 61 or 60-plus games in a while. So we were beating teams by halftime. Some of these games were over and decided, especially against the lesser teams, the expansion teams, was it 88 and 90. So we were running roughshod through the league. And when now we did sweep the Pistons, we beat them twice by double digits. And I think we had them down by 20 in game four, and their egos could not handle it. Before that wasn't something that was impromptu. Right. That was talked about. You can see Isaiah on the bench talking to some of his teammates about this is what we're going to do. And even mentioning something to Chuck Daly, who did not seem to be on board with what it was that they were discussing. And I always liked Chuck. He was a great coach. May he rest peacefully. But he was a great coach and a professional. And I could see he wasn't down with whatever it was that they were saying, but they walked off the court. And MJ and I are standing right there, shoulder to shoulder. Right. I'm watching each of these cats go by, and Isaiah even kind of ducked down and stuck around a couple of his teammates. And so we were disbelief at the time, but by the time we got back to the locker room, I remember MJ going, I can't stand a MF-er that can't take a whooping like a man. And I think he used a couple other expletives in there as well. But we were so excited to be going to the NBA Finals that we didn't let that bother our celebration one bit. We got showered and back on the plane with our championship hats and T-shirts, and we were going to the NBA Finals and the chance to beat the Lakers. Giddy's all get up because we realized how hard we had worked to earn that home court advantage and how the main goal was to beat the damn Pistons. And not only did we beat them so bad they lost their dignity in the loss.
I heard a interview by John Sally one time talking about that moment, and it was funny because he mentioned how he asked Chuck Daly if he could go back in the game, so he couldn't walk off the court. He knew what was going to happen, and he didn't want to be a part of it, so he asked Chuck to put him back in the game. He didn't know it was a blowout, so he couldn't be a part of it. He'd have to stay on the court. So I found that
there was some players. I'm not gonna say it was the entire team. I remember Joe Dumars being out there, and I think Sally was one of the guys kind of mealing around. We didn't have courtside celebrations back then like they do now. I mean, they pop champagne, I think, after every playoff win. We didn't do it like that. You know, your only chance is to taste that champagne and feel that sting in your eyes and shower your teammates with it and let it sink into your jersey and into your socks and your sneakers after you won the championship. It was the only right that you got. You didn't get it for winning the Eastern Conference Finals. You know, you got that right when you won it all. And I think there's something special about that is a little lost on some of these players today.
Now, as painful it may be for me, the Knicks, I'm a big Knicks guy. The Knicks come about the year after with Pat Riley, his first year. You guys are going for your title defense. They take you to seven games, the first year under Riley, when you guys prevailed in seven in Chicago. And the next year, they had the home court advantage. They had the 60-win season. Everything seemed to be going in their favor. And yet you guys pulled one out again in six games, winning in Chicago again. Talk about that rivalry. And then on top of that, in 94, when the Knicks finally prevailed in the semifinals in seven games again, when Jordan took his baseball break, it was still an intense rivalry, intense series. Talk about that rivalry between you two. And do you consider it a rivalry if you guys won at all the big moments?
Battle, whatever you want to call it, those guys were loaded. I mean, and Pat Riley, phenomenal coach, obviously Hall of Famer, you know. He had those cats riled up. I mean, think about a lineup of Ewing and Oakley and Smith and Anthony Mason, Xavier McDaniel, Herb Williams. I mean, you know, Starks and Doc Rivers and all these cats that they had. He had them all spun and wound so tight. They were trying to take our heads off of our star players, Michael and Scotty, when they would come down the lane. I remember, you know, X getting in Scotty's face, then Michael coming over and getting in X's face. And I come over like, hey, guys, let's not have a fight out here. I didn't really want a piece of X, man. X looked like he literally might bite you the way Mike Tyson used to do in a fight. Guy looked like he'd be dirty. But they were intense battles. The games were great. The worst thing that happened to the Knicks, when they had a great team, they had won 27 straight games at home. And they had cleaned our clocks the first two games of the series in New York. And word got out by the press that MJ had left New York and gone down to Atlantic City to go gambling. And it was the reason why we lost game number two. He had a kind of a subpar performance for him, which was still pretty darn good. And that lit a fire in MJ. And that was the worst thing to happen. We ended up beating four straight after that. You remember Charles Smith under the basket in front of our bench. you know, with us up one trying to score against the likes of Scottie Pippen and his long arms and long fingers, and Michael Jordan stripping the damn ball away from him, and Horace Grant coming over and blindsiding them. Poor dude didn't have a chance.
I'll tell you what, I remember as a
sports that you go, you wish never it would happen to anybody, certainly not a good dude as Charles Smith. But, you know, in one of the things the fan bases never forget, right? Great player, college in the NBA, and he probably known for getting his shot blocked four times. That would have put the Knicks probably, they go up 3-2 in that series. It's probably not looking real good for us as winning that three-peat. But when we win that game, you can feel the air go out of that arena and that team. And we ended up smashing them in Chicago two nights later by close to 20 points.
I'll tell you, the game, the Charles Smith game, is the one that all Knicks fans remember and agonize over from that 93 conference finals. And honestly, for me, as a fan, it was game three of that series in Chicago when Michael Jordan didn't have a Michael Jordan-type game, and the Bulls still blew out the Knicks by about 20 points. On a night when Jordan didn't have his, you know, I think the next night he had 50-plus in game four and really took control. But with that game three, that really could have been something else if the Knicks had, you know, been able to pull out on a night, took advantage of a night when Jordan wasn't at his superstar, all-time great self. The one thing I wanted to ask you, too, in 94, I know it might be a sore spot, but I want to ask you about the Scottie Pippen game in game three of that series, when you guys are down 2-0 in that series, you come back and it's 1.8 seconds left. The Knicks had just tied it on a Ewing jumper. It came all the way back from way down. Take us to that huddle and how everything, from your perspective, how everything went down there.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And I've always felt for Scottie on that. And I was afraid that he would be one of those things that he might always be remembered for in his career, special player as he was. I remember I watched his game just take off after the 92 Olympics when he got a chance to play with those greats like Larry Bird and Ewing, Drexler, Stockton, Malone, MJ, Charles Barkley. I mean, the list goes on and on, right? So his game was good, and then it went to a different level after that. And by 94, when Joe retired, Scottie carried us. We had won, I think we lost one more game than we had the year before, or maybe the same record. He was in top three for the MVP voting. Yep. He had a phenomenal year. Rebounds, points, assists, running the point four. I mean, he did it all for our ball club. And I think that Pip got outside of what his true personality was. He wasn't like that. He was selfishness. He was one of my favorite teammates. We hung out on the road in bars and restaurants and nightclubs all the time. Quick to pick up a check. Now, he wouldn't tip the hostess, but
no tipping Pippen.
I remember, you know, I'm working on a minimum contract from year to year, so he was quick to pick up a check. He just wouldn't tip. but they call him No Tip and Pippin. I hope he doesn't get a chance to see this. He's going to kill me. My phone will be ringing tomorrow.
I said it, not you.
Yeah. But anyway, he was a great dude. So for him to do that at that time, it really threw us for a loop. I remember Bill Cartwright crying in the locker room afterwards. Bill was our big, strong center. He never showed any emotions, you know, unless he was inflicting pain on somebody else, you know, at the center spot, battling Ewing and Keem Olajuwon and some of the other top centers in the league. I learned all my tricks of the trade from Teach. You know, that was what we called him, because he would teach us, you know, how to use our hips and our forearms and our chest and our elbows and your fingers. If he had to gouge a guy, I think Cartwright would do it. But so see him break down and John Paxson give an emotional speech. And we were in the locker room for a long time before they opened it up to the press. And Scottie was, you know, sad, but we had run that same play that we ran earlier in the year. I think it was against Milwaukee or somebody. And co-coach hit the game winning shot.
It was against the Pacers.
I got Scottie Pippen, the best, our best passer, passing the ball to one of our guys who's long and athletic and can shoot it from the outside and already made a shot in a big moment like that. So, you know, he goes to the bench and I think they put in, who we have as his
Pete back. Myers?
Yeah, Pete Myers. Thank Pete you. Myers great.
Made the, sorry, made the pass.
Yeah, getting old. So Pete Myers delivers the strike and Kukoc hits the shot. I remember picking Kukoc up. And I wasn't his biggest fan to start the season because I hadn't heard about Krause talking about how good he was for all them years. But Tony was a great guy and obviously a Hall of Fame player, as it turned out to be. Hitting that shot, we were so excited. But then we remembered, now we got to go in a locker room and deal with this aftermath of Pip sitting out that game and letting us all down. And he came back and he had a great series in game four. And then he fouls Hubert Davis on this mystery call.
It was legit. Come on, Scott. It was legit. It was legit. Come on.
That would cost us the game. But we had a great year. I wouldn't change anything about that season. We had a bunch of competitors. I think everybody had written us off after Jordan went and played baseball. But we had a real tight knit squad, and I thought we overachieved. We did not underachieve on that squad whatsoever.
Awesome, Scott. Well, we're going to take a quick break here as we have reached our halftime buzzer, and we'll be back with you guys shortly. And we're back here for our shortened second half here. Scott, really appreciate all the stories and transparency on tonight's show. We want to kind of shift things kind of more so to the current NBA, and since you are a guy that did spend 15 years in the league as a player, also spent time as a coach, first question for you, a big one right now, is the current issue in the NBA regarding load management. Now, coming from your era and the stories that you just shared, of course, that was non-existent back in the day. But what are your thoughts on load management, and do you have any type of opinion or even a solution for what the league can do? And I'm curious to hear from a player because, of course, you know, the Players Association, things of that nature. Do you see them coming to any type of agreement on a resolution?
Yeah, I don't know how they're going to handle it from Players Association and NBA front offices. Above my pay grade, try to stay in my lane. But I know as a player, I wanted to play. I wanted to entertain. I wanted to get out there and work that hard in practice in grade school. You only got so many games, so many years you can play and games that you can play in. I don't think to me, well, everyone says, well, I take games off so I can play longer in the league. Well, yeah, I don't know if that's how it's supposed to be done. I think you're stacking plenty of chips. Money's phenomenal that these guys are making. So they're stacking big piles. What I got away from my early playing days and career, which really propelled me to be a 15-year pro. It wasn't talent alone. It was the veteran leadership that I had that taught me how always to be pro. Always be pro. That's why I hear those Paxson, Cartwright, Hodges, and Jordan always talking about, whether you're on the court, playing a game, whether you're in practice, a film session, whether you're doing stuff in the community, a hospital visit, a court dedication, be a pro. Show up on time. You show up with enthusiasm, and you do the best job that you possibly can. You lock in for that commitment that you're going to be there, whether it's 60 minutes or a four hour game time. You want everybody in that arena to be that even when you're not playing, you're sitting on the bench, that you're locked in, that you're professional, and that to me translates to guys playing. That they would respect the game, the guys that came before them enough, the family of four that's paying $275. Well, shoot, that's what it was back in my days. Probably double that now to come to an NBA game. You know, getting popcorn, sodas, and a hot dog plus parking and tickets. Heck, it's probably $500 easy. And for a star player to then say, "Well, you know, this is the fourth night, five games. I'm going to sit this one out." I think it's not fair. It's not fair to the people that are putting the butts in the seats. It's being selfish that you're trying to maybe extend your career, or I think it discounts the true chase for championship, the grueling grind of a 82-game season back in the day was part of all of that. And they have more masseuses and modalities and ways to keep these guys fresh in recovery. Yet there's still just as many injuries or more than when we had back when we played. And I don't know if it's because, you know, we used to shoot guys up with cortisone shots in the knees. I can attest to that. And throw us back out there to keep us playing. The guys doctors would never do these days, and players certainly would never take the needle. But that's what we did to stay on that court, right? You make it $150,000 and you're on a non-guaranteed contract and your finger comes dislocated. You ain't taking 3 to 4 weeks off. You're going to buddy tape that sucker up and get out there and start battling against those dudes like Kevin Willis underneath the basket, right? You just got to do it.
Does the eras aside, because obviously everybody takes this year over previous years, everybody can debate that, but to what you just talked about with load management, does that change your perception of certain players? I'm not going to get specific or anything like that, but certain players who are considered stars or whatever, does that change your perception of them in the based on, you know, the load management, the way it's – not the era of which they're playing, because that's really not fair because that's just how it is. But the idea of sitting and not playing with – injury management, you know, is on the box score now. Does that change your perception of some of these guys who want or have the label as superstars compared to other stars?
I don't know if it changes my perception of them. I think our era was better. I'm one of these old crusty dudes right. That thinks, oh, that might as well, back when I played, you know, it was
and that's how it is. Right. I get that.
You know, I don't like seeing a game 137 or 128. You know, I don't really dig that. First of all, I couldn't score. I was a defensive guy. Most of the teams, Jordan and Pippen, they weren't giving me no shots. I'd be wide open in the block. They'd be like, yeah, swing it. maybe I got a little bit of, I guess I'm salty about that. But, I prefer a game that's 106 to 101 or 102. More than a game that's, you know, that's the score going into the fourth quarter. I just can't get with that. So I don't like the era more than I'll say the guys with the load management bother me. I don't turn in to watch as many basketball games. I still peep at a Thursday TNT game because I like, you know, listening to Charles and Kenny and Shaq and of course Ernie. You kind of direct those guys, or sometimes there's no directions. Crazy.
That's about you can.
I'll watch that and you know the pregame, the halftime show. But the game itself, it's a different brand of basketball. And but until it comes to the playoffs, I don't really tune in too much. But I am excited because Ross, you know, as we are both here in Phoenix, we got Kevin Durant. And even though I played with LeBron, he's my favorite current player in the NBA. So I'm real excited to be able to go down and watch him for a couple regular season games. I'll be hitting up Mark West for some tickets. He's our NBA alumni with the Suns to go through and get some tickets.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned KD because we're going to get into some rapid fire questions here for our final quarter with you. What's your thoughts on the big trade for Phoenix? Of course, I would say this is probably the most historic trade of all time. I think this, me speaking here, I think it's bigger than been the Barkley trade to get a guy like Kevin Durant to the Phoenix Suns with what they already have in place. What's your thoughts on this team? And do you think they have a legitimate chance this year to kind of just turn things around from, I think they're currently like sixth in the West and come up atop the West and win it all?
Yeah, I got him at fifth in the West, 9.5 back. I don't know if they have enough time to develop the chemistry to run down. Who the heck is it now? The Nuggets. Sorry, Nuggets are they have a 9.5 game. Yeah, the Suns currently in fifth. So I don't think they're going to run them down, but I don't think they have to. I think what they have to do, and I don't know how many games, and generally I would say 25 to 40 games it takes to get that kind of chemistry with a superstar player. You bring them into a new team. But because you've got a veteran like CP3, Chris Paul, an unselfish star that's already there, and Devin Booker, a younger big, I know Ayton's in, I guess, fourth or fifth year, but still a younger big that will listen to a guy like Durant, who's got that MVP award and championship ring. I think I can do it in a shorter period of time. So I'd like to say, you know, 13 to 18 games, something like that, 12 to 15 maybe even, that they can start to develop that chemistry. So can they, as long as they can probably try to get in that top four, maybe top three, they are currently a game and a half behind the Kings. So if they can run down that, get in that top three spot, I think that gives them a good positioning for the playoffs. It's really, listen, it's finals or bust for them. They've rolled all their chips with the guys that they've given up and the draft choices that they've given up. But I think they can do it. I honestly believe it's healthy. KD comes back healthy from the knee injury that he has. I'm excited about what this team's going to bring to the Valley.
Absolutely. I mean, we can already feel the excitement here, and I'm happy for Suns fans just having a chance to get this opportunity with a superstar like KD, because it's not every day that you're able to go out and just acquire a guy like that at the deadline. So super exciting time here. Now, to flip to the Eastern Conference here, of course, a lot of people have heard my stories about Giannis. We were working together in Milwaukee together during Giannis's rookie year. Talk a little bit about him, what you saw from him as a coach, working with him on the floor as a big, and maybe just share kind of like one memory of like, wow, like he's really special. Like when did you know that he might have what it takes to get to an all-star level? I don't think anyone here would say after his rookie year, this guy would be arguably the best player in the league, but just talk about that experience being a coach for Giannis.
Well, I probably, maybe a better coach than I'd ever be a general manager. And I knew they picked him, in the first round as a young skinny kid from Greece. And, I think he was barely averaging double figures over there. So someone saw the potential way before I did. I knew he my biggest takeaway from him, though, early on outside of, I don't know about this guy, was he puts in the work. And this kid likes to compete. I remember some of the shooting games that they would have with O.J. Mayo and Chris Middleton. Those guys would just go down there, and we would just throw them passes after passes after passes. And Giannis didn't win it many, if any, of those games. He'd want to play another and another and another until he could get a win. And oftentimes he wouldn't. And we would literally just have to take the basketballs off the court, lock them in the storage facility, so he would have to go home at that point. That was his thirst to want to get better. First in the gym, always the last to leave. Lifting weight. I told him, I saw him at a holiday game in New York over Christmas time. And I said, you would have had those muscles back when you were 18. We wouldn't have got fired as a coaching staff. Yeah. We were god awful. We only won 15 games. Remember that, Robbie?
How can I forget?
I'm so proud of his development. I did not see a two-time MVP coming, but I knew the kid was going to be a good, solid player in this league for a long time. An all-star, yes. An all-pro, I didn't see that. I didn't see MVP.
I think we'd be lying if anyone said they saw that from Jump Street. So I'm right there with you, Scott. Now, kind of going back to you and your career, I find it impressive. You're a career 72% shooter from the foul line as an NBA big. That's not bad. We'll take that any day of the week. Sign me up. So my question for you is, what was the key to your success? And then just being a former player and assistant coach, why do you think a lot of these NBA bigs struggle from the foul line? What goes wrong? Is it more mental, or is it something with just the big hands? Like what is it?
Well, first of all, I sucked in college. I sucked in the early part of my career. I had a coach in Milwaukee that helped, assistant coach, that helped me with my stroke. And he said, you got too much going on. First of all, the longer part of guys, or the guys are 6'10", 6'11", over 7-footers, is we have more things that can go wrong before the ball releases from our arms, right? So the shorter player, shorter wingspan, less to keep in alignment with the rim. For us, he told me, shorten your stroke up some. Don't start bringing the balls. I always bring the ball kind of below my waistband up into my shooting motion. Well, that just extra foot of movement it was enough to, you know, cause something to go wrong. My shoulder wasn't right, and my elbow wasn't right, and my wrist angle wasn't right, and my forearm. Well, there's so many things that just micro movements you have to try to correct. If you feel it going wrong, now all of a sudden you're not thinking about your follow through and the back of the rim. So all these little factors come and said, he just shortened my stroke up. So one of my proudest moments was I went from, you know, kind of that high 60s and low 70s. I was shooting 85, 87 for a stretch in the playoffs in Milwaukee at one point in time in 2001. So I was feeling real good about what I was doing later in my career. And it took me a while to understand, yeah, that's what you got to do. Make things as simple as possible at the free throw line by shortening the movements that you have to make.
Gotcha. And where I'm going with this now, of course, is Ben Simmons. Obviously, he's around your size. Kind of just talk about that current situation. Is this something you think he can work through? And is there any advice you would offer him as a coach if you were coaching him?
Well, you know, for me, it was a physical thing, right? It was mechanics. I don't think that's the deal with him. I think now it's mental. And that might be tougher and above my pay grade to be able to offer any advice on that. So I know there's a lot of sports psychologists that would probably love to work with him because I think they would be in agreement with me. The guy's game is too nice. He's too athletic and probably smart enough to be able to figure things out. But once it becomes a mental issue and a mental hangout, and you've letting fans and social media and everybody else get inside your noggin, you're toast. And I think that's unfortunately what has happened to Ben.
But if you were his teammate, though, and you're getting doubled on the block because he's just left wide open, I mean, you would want him to shoot the ball, right? Like just a few times, take a couple so that you're a little bit of a threat out there, right? I mean, just thinking as like a guy that's posted up on the block, Simmons has the ball because he is a fantastic creator for others. It's like, you know, you got to show it a little bit, just flash it.
I agree, Ross. You know, I my senior year in North Carolina was pretty good down on the blocks, but we had a guy named King Rice. I love you, King. But that dude couldn't hit the backboard. And a lot of times they would just sag off of him, and it's like having a man and a half down around you when you're trying to post up to try to receive the ball. He was a great passer, great ball handler, but just a poor shooter. And one time I just told him, I was just like, dude, you just got to snap off a couple just so they'll honor you. Even if you go 1 for 4 early in the ball game, it's going to open things up for me a little down low. And, you know, I started doing that towards this latter part of the season. I start, you know, I've coming back from, like I said, an appendectomy surgery anyway, but started getting a little bit more points. And I think the team started playing a little bit better as a result down the stretch. We went from one of Dean's worst teams to making it out of the Sweet 16. So we were really, or making it to the Sweet 16. So we were really proud of that. But for Ben, I think the same thing. He's got to just have that mental approach that, you know, I'm putting in the time and practice, and I got to have confidence to go ahead and do it in the games.
Yeah. Now, going back to LA here, you were former teammates with Darvin Ham. Kind of just want to get your thoughts on how you think he's navigated this season being a first year head coach. And you think the Lakers have a chance to make the playoffs, or what's your take on LA's chances here down the stretch?
Well, I wrote down the top 8 teams. I didn't even go down there far enough to see where the Lakers are at. I don't know what position they're in, Ross. You'd have to help me with that one. Yeah, I love LeBron James. I had him as a 19-year-old. The dude worked hard. I remember taking a charge early in training camp from him, and we both go down on the ground, and I'm thinking, oh God, I hope I hurt this young dude. And then as I start to try to get up, those little dash and those flashlights start hitting your eyeballs. You're like, damn, I hope this young kid didn't hurt me. And I was 37.
Yeah.
He's 19. I'm older than his mom. What am I worried about him for? And I love LeBron. He's one of these load management guys too, unfortunately now. And you know, he got a lot of miles on that body. But when you're fighting for a playoff spot, I think you have to change your thinking some. Maybe you don't play as many minutes. Maybe that's the thing that they can start doing, saying, hey, I'm going to play as many minutes rather than sitting out the entire basketball game. when you fight for your playoff life, and I don't know how many more seasons he's got left in those legs, you would think he'd want to win another title before he is done. And I know they got the bubble title, and I think it's, you know, I think he's at 4 championships now. Yep. And a lot of, you know, in the scoring title that he recently got, congratulations LeBron on that. But if you want to separate yourself from Michael and consider yourself the greatest of all time, and I know there's the debate right now, and arguably it goes one side of the other. I think it's probably 60-40. We'll probably say Michael, and some of the younger generation will say LeBron. But you know, if you ever want to swing that the other way, that teeter totter the other way, he's going to have to start putting some more rings on his fingers and getting some more deep playoff runs.
Do you think there's any value in the fact that he's defeating Father Time? I mean, obviously Father Time's undefeated, but what he's been able to do this year at his age 38, I mean, do you think there's ever a point to where if he's averaging 24 a game at age 40, where we can put him in that conversation with Mike, even despite not having as many rings?
Well, no, not for me, because it's not about statistical points, you know. I respect the fact that he surpassed Kareem. I think that's wonderful. I mean, he's going to hold that title for a long time. Only guy that might be able to catch him, I think, right now is Durant. But Durant, he doesn't stay as healthy as LeBron did, and I don't know if he's got as many playoff wins in him either. So he's going to hold that title for a long time, if not, shit, it'll be probably long after I'm. You know, I'm taking a dirt nap. it's one of those things that it's not a statistical thing for me, though. It's doing it on the greatest stage, right? Like MJ had a different gear than everybody else that's considered a superstar Hall of Famer. He had a different gear, something that separated him as a flair, a charisma, a willingness to win, never losing a title. In the NBA, the NBA Finals series, that is so impressive that like, a lot of these guys have to try to chase that. And you know, even a guy like Steph Curry, who's won four titles now, I don't think that he's ever going to get to that level of status as great as he shoots the basketball. And I love watching. I remember in Milwaukee playing with his father, and he'd run around as a little ball boy shagging balls with his brother Seth. You know, now these guys, one of the greatest shooters in the history of the game, at least as far as making threes.
Yeah. And last question, really appreciate your time here tonight, Scott. You know, we talked about Giannis and you being with him while he was young. You were obviously with Jordan when he was still in his younger years. With LeBron, is there any type of memory or moment, maybe off the court or in practice, where you really just saw how special of a talent he was?
I'll give you something off the court that maybe we didn't talk about his talent, but maybe his mentality. When I was a young player with the Bulls, MJ used to play in the high money game in the back, but he would always come up front and play with the young guys, myself, Stacey King, BJ Armstrong, even Will Perdue. We'd be playing blackjack up front, and he'd grab the cards and say, I'll be the house. You guys bet whatever makes you uncomfortable. And it was a way of MJ spending time with the guys in the back of the plane and coming up and spending time with the guys in the front of the plane. And I would share these types of stories with LeBron as we played cards, you know, what these guys were like, not so much for their work ethic and how they, you know, did how many jumpers they shot in the summer each day, or working on a post-up game with me playing one-on-one after practice. It was the mentality that he had to become a leader. And that's what LeBron really didn't have when I got there as a 19-year-old. He's going to be 20 in December. He developed his leadership ability and be able to connect with his teammates. One of the things he always, at least early on he did, when he'd sign an endorsement deal with somebody, I don't care if it was Beats by Dre or Ray-Ban or whatever, he'd make sure his teammates got a pair in the locker room waiting for him when he came back. And that started to develop a trust and leadership, and then became more vocal, pulling guys aside, not in an embarrassing way, pointing out, no, we didn't talk about doing the pick and roll that way. We're going to do it this way. and guys would listen and they'd buy in and they started winning there, you know, and that was a cool thing to watch. Now they got swept by the Spurs and then he had to jump ship and go down to Miami to get that championship ring. But by then he'd become a force in the league and a leader of men. And that was cool to watch that development.
Great stuff, Scott. Well, we really appreciate you stopping by the 48 Minutes podcast. Be on the lookout for his book here in a couple weeks. It's called Through the Fire, a memoir of trauma and loss, basketball and triumph. Scott, really want to thank you for being here tonight. Thanks for tuning in to all our listeners. And we will be back with everybody on Monday night. And really love catching up with you, Scott. We'll have to get together soon. And once again, thank you.
Thank you guys very much, Roth World B. It was a blast. I hope I didn't get a little too foamy at the mouth tonight. I hope your listeners will like the pod.
Absolutely. All right. Take care, everybody.